I have a people-pleasing element inside mm-hmm. me that I don't want to offend people. But when it comes to these things, I think I have a responsibility to say what needs to be said.
This is Writer's Mosaic, in conversation. Screenwriter Johnny Wright talks to writer Nels Abbey about putting the things that are on his mind down on paper.
Hi, I'm Johnny Wright, and I'm here with Writer's Mosaic in my office, interviewing a wonderful writer that is Nels Abbey. How are you doing, Nels?
I'm doing very well, Johnny. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and how would you describe yourself as a writer?
It's actually probably the best question I've ever been asked. Never been asked to describe myself as a writer. I think I'm just a guy who has things on his mind and puts them to paper in the way that they come through my mind. So often when I'm writing, I think it reads like I'm speaking or so, and it's just my thoughts, my very, very convoluted thoughts sometimes, just polished up a little bit more to make them a bit less convoluted. But I like to think that how I write, how I speak, and I speak with quite a strong and somewhat sometimes modelled mind. But at the core of what I do, I think I'm most comfortable in the realm of satire. I think that's me, and that's what I do, and that's what I do well.
And then, as a satirist, I read the amazing book, which you're actually holding now, called Think Like a White Man.
So it cost me a lot of money, this book has. One day, hopefully it pays.
It cost you a lot of money.
Well, it's cost me a lot of money, absolutely, absolutely. The lost earnings, boy, you don't want to know.
Yeah. So, you talk about lost earnings. So, you describe the book for the listeners.
Yeah, so Think Like a White Man is a book about how to make it in the corporate world as a black person. But it's actually using the corporate world as a metaphor for being black pretty much in the world altogether. It's a book about navigating the world as a black person. And that's pretty much what it's about from head to toe. It really looks at white supremacy, racism, and pretty much many other ills directly in the eye, and just gives somewhat facetious methods of navigating your way through them.
And I got it. I mean, it was almost a self-help book.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not so... I first came across this book from my wife got it, who works in corporate law.
Yeah.
So she, I think a lot of it was resonating with her being in that very white corporate law setting. It's written by Nels Abbey, but the book is as if it is written by...
Yeah, Dr. Boulay Whitelaw III, who's now a professor. He's now moved up to Professor Boulay Whitelaw. We're trying to catch up with KD Andrews. as he's breathing down KD's neck, trying to be his competition. But it's written by this satirical... world's leading expert on whiteness or so, or white people, who's this professor. And I created this character who's a bit older than me, much older than me actually or so. And I just wanted him to be somebody who could actually really say the things I just couldn't. And there's so much that I just couldn't say. I couldn't write any of this book, truth be told, from my own perspective. And when I tried to, the words just weren't coming. It's when Boulay Whitelaw came into my life with all of his drama and all of his... So Boulay Whitelaw, rock star academic, brilliant guy also, but as many academics will know also, after a bit of time, the fast life, the drugs, the champagne, the cocaine, everything else, it takes its toll. The fast women, and the fast men too, on the other side of things, it takes its toll on you. It's taking its toll on him. And he just wanted to put all of his experiences of navigating this world, not just the good side, but the bad side too, the hard side, the white supremacy side of things. He wanted to put it into one place, and I was the vessel through which he did it.
So what type of... Because you described lots of different types of black men.
Yep.
Black people.
Yep.
In this book. What type of black person is Dr. Boulay Whitelaw? What type of black person is he?
He's an office revolutionary.
But we're also talking about Johnny Juscom.
So Johnny Juscom, or JJC. It's a common term, actually, certainly in Africa, maybe the Caribbean too. It reflects that person who's just pretty much moved to a particular place. So in the Western context, it just means a person who's moved to the West. So, and I often point out in the book too, that a black person in Nigeria is not really a black person per se. You are a African, you're a Nigerian, but you don't have to contend with the idea of blackness, because blackness is pretty much the oxygen.
And I guess your identity is tribal in Nigeria.
Yeah, tribal per se, or more, it's more ethnic, are you with me? It's more ethnic or nationalistic.
Mm-hmm.
So the term tribal, so, is actually one, because you actually ask most African people...
Am I going to get cancelled?
No, of course not. But if you actually ask most African people to say the word tribe in their own ethnic language, they can't say it because it doesn't exist.
Ah.
Because it's actually an imposed term that the Europeans came with, and it's just a subjugated colonial term. But it's just a crazy one. But the funny thing about it, you take for example, so when they speak of say tribes in Nigeria or so, you make it, they often, when I was little, I something that was just a couple of hundred people, even when they speak of Native American tribes, a couple of hundred. But you would never know there was actually millions upon millions. There's more, say, Hausa people than there are British people. Or say, for example, there's 60 million Yoruba people, there's about 4 million Scottish people. The Yoruba people are told you're a tribe and you have to be hoovered up into this nation called Nigeria, but Scottish people are a nation unto themselves.
Or something. I think you said the British fucked the borders up in Africa worse than...
Kwasi Kwarteng's hairline, absolutely. Exactly. Kwasi loves his hairline. Other than that, he would have just shaved. You got to let it go, Kwasi. Cut the hair off. But I'll say, so look, you take a look at it. So you've got Johnny just come. And that's the black person you just meet. And those people tend to be privileged. So when you turn around, you meet an African or maybe a Caribbean person in the corporate world who's just arrived here. It's very difficult to navigate everything to get into a corporate position in this side of the world as somebody who just arrived in this country. And so the norm is, it's somebody who probably would have gone to a private school or something else like that here, just got here, came here to do university or something else, and then they just stuck around. So the most senior banker, black banker in British history, I think it might still be the case, was a guy called Tiam Tijani. He's actually a prince from Ivory. Wow. I believe he's from Ivory Coast. He's a Francophone. He's about 6'4". He's a Francophone. He used to run the company called Credit Suisse. And then you've also got the white person trapped in black skin. Who everybody's met a black person who's pretty much who's trapped in a black person who happens to be white. You've got white chocolate, who's pretty much a white person who happens to be down with black people. And then you've also got the undercover brother, who's the cold cut, maneuvering, scheming person who would do anything whatsoever to get to the top. And finally, you've got the shook one, and of course you've got the streets in the suit. And I think that captures every black person you'll meet in the corporate world, maybe even outside the corporate world, is going to fall into one of those categories.
So
and
which category are you?
That's a very good question, actually. There's also the balanced black professional, which means that you're pretty much a composite of all of those things, and you're pretty much, you're likely to just end up in the middle somewhere. And so which one am I? I'm certainly not white chocolate. I don't think I'm an undercover brother. I'm not Johnny Just Come, or maybe I was for a little bit, but I'm not that rich. I'm certainly not, I don't think I'm streets in a suit. Probably balanced black professional, I'm afraid. Yeah, and I've got the balance, the bank balance to show for it too. So yeah.
Okay, so what I'm trying to work out here is that job, as interesting as it sounds,
it's not interesting.
Doesn't sound that creative.
No, it's not creative at all. No.
So how did we get from that job to think like a white man?
But I think that's part of the problem, though. You go into the corporate world or so, and people have to work there on the 9-to-5. And I firmly believe that the average human being that actually has some creative is quite a creative person.
Mm-hmm.
That the average human being is not born to be doing mundane tasks or so. You're born to figure out and think things through and try and build a better world or so. And I just don't really think that that's so... So often when you work in the corporate world, you find that you might have very creative people or brilliant people in different ways, mathematically or scientifically brilliant people, who then are working in the corporate world. So a lot of times you find scientists working as fund managers. But for me personally, I worked over in the corporate world. I worked a long, hard slug, but I just had this thing inside me that I just couldn't let go. I only went to the corporate world because I couldn't get jobs in the creative world. So, and I started getting wrong. My whole life again was risk management. So I studied economics, business economics at university, because the idea of studying something creative was completely outside of the realm. But I still worked in magazines and everything else when I was at university, when I was younger. So I'd write for all sorts of publications, but I still didn't have that belief in myself that I would graduate and see myself walking into a magazine or into, say, the BBC on a day-to-day basis and earn a living.
So you're doing freelance writing?
Freelance writing.
And how did you get into that? And what magazines were you doing freelance writing for?
I did some magazines for the hip-hop magazines across the spectrum. Principally, that was pretty much it. Then after a while, I then broke into the black publications or the newspapers and everything else and became a bit more serious. There's one of the places where I really enjoyed, I didn't get to write for them, but the place I really just learned a lot about writing from was a small website called playahater.com, which was spelled PLAYA. HATA, which was it was basically politics and hip hop together, and then and it was the two things just merged into a world which is very, very different. I was looking at the two things and it just really merged that world in a way, and I never pitched to them because I never thought I was good enough to pitch to them. And I never thought I was just that. So I picked you name what the publication I wrote for them, but I never thought I was good enough to write for those particular people.
Going back to doing freelance writing for magazines when you're at university, and I'm guessing afterwards as well?
Yeah, not as much after, because when I finished university, WordPress had come about.
Okay.
So what happened was that, the magazines that people had been able to work for at the time, or so be it, across the board, across the spectrum, both here and America, or so, Source, WXL, Tense, Hip Hop Connection, all those sorts of things, they were wiped out. They were killed by the net. So you take, for example, so when I then graduated, they were contracting very, very quickly. So when you, so in the past or so, a dream of mine, I always looked up to people like, say, an Elliot Wilson, at WXL Magazine, who was this revolutionary. I don't know if you ever read WXL back
then. I did read I read all the ones you mentioned.
Used to have, he was so creative, he turned his editorial column into this satirical rap battle every single month, and it was really funny. And so the magazines used to have, for younger generation, magazines always used to have the editor's note at the beginning. And then he would turn it, it was always just traditional, we have this person in the magazine, that person talking about, but he just turned it into just insulting the source every single month. And it became to the point where it just got so bad that Benzino of the Source actually went and stormed his offices. And it was, again, I thought I wanted to be in that world, that was for me, but the world was contracting so quickly. I just had to go get a job.
Yeah.
So I then went, I worked, went into financial services.
So then, well, when you were doing magazine articles, and now you write for papers such as The Guardian and stuff like that, how does pitching, just for listeners who might be wanting to get into writing, how does pitching an idea work?
I'll be completely honest with you. It's almost like cold calling to begin with, until you build your name.
Okay.
Or, again, nepotism is real. If people know you, or you know somebody inside, or you've got an in, you're lucky. So networking is essential, and then meeting people. So when you hear there's an event going on here at so-and-so place, make your face known. You have to go to places, because the more people know you, the more people might give you an opportunity or take a chance, or you might just take a liking to you also. And that's a very, very good thing. The second thing is, maybe sometimes, and a lot of time it doesn't work, is the old cold calling, because a lot of times these editors just receive a slew of pitches in the actual publications. But for me, nowadays or so, I would, if I was starting out again, I would definitely have a website, I would definitely be on Substack, I would definitely be making my presence known on Twitter or in other places, or getting my thoughts out there, really just sharing my work.
And what would you be putting on a website? Would you be writing articles for free?
I would be, you've got to take some of this, you're always going to pay your dues, no matter what industry you go into, there's always a hazing process. And for writers, the hazing process can be much of your life if you're not careful, unless you're very lucky. I think that the key thing is that A, get to know people. B, just pitch. C, get your work out there.
And
just,
what are you pitching? So you've got a hip-hop magazine, for example.
Yeah, they don't exist anymore, Jupiter.
Okay, bad example. But okay, The Guardian.
Yeah, The Guardian, yeah. So what you want, but so The Guardian essentially is like this, is that if there's something in the news, they're probably going to want to react to it on the comment desk.
Yeah.
So if there's a big story in the news, they're going to want to react to it on the comment desk. So you have to find a way, essentially, to bring an angle to the table that might not be covered, that might not be too obvious. But at the same time, but would still have broad appeal. Remember, it's broad casting, broad sheets. You want it to be read by as many people, as large a group of people as possible. So you have to find that particular way to pitch to them in a way that's going to appeal to them, so they can think, okay, this would get A, is intellectually robust, B, it's aligned with our brand, and C, it's aligned with our values, and D, pretty much it will be well read.
And how have you found that? Because unless you're pitching to, say, Their Voice, you're the wider audience.
I worked at The Voice for about 5-6 years as a columnist. Yeah,
great. Mm-hmm. And if you're not pitching to them, so you pitch to let's say The Guardian, liberal newspaper, but a white liberal newspaper.
Yeah.
So how does that work? In that there is an audience that you know you have to kind of not necessarily appease, but who's going to be reading it? So how black can you be when you're pitching to The Guardian?
It depends on who, on the editor you're also pitching to, too. So sometimes when you've got a friend on the inside, it can actually help you. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty black in The Guardian, Jupiter. Mm-hmm. I like to think I keep it blacker than the back of your neck. You know what I mean? But And I think that's just, so I do, Kendi does, Afua does, so a lot of the black writers, but Gary, the, I almost said the late Gary Young, Gary Young's far from late, Gary Young's still with us.
Yeah.
So Gary
as
Young,
of time of recording.
So, yeah, so The Guardian is welcoming to black writers who are black, and that's a good thing. It's not that rare. If you say, are pitching to, say, the Daily Mail,
mm-hmm.
and you think you're going to keep it blacker than black, I'm sorry, you're just not. You're wasting your time. You're pitching to, actually, most British newspapers. If you're thinking, yeah, you're going to keep it black, it's just not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only, say, The Guardian, The Independent, maybe, The Eye, some places or so, Metro. There are some publications out there, but the broadsheets or so, the agenda-setting quality newspapers are largely are right-leaning, very, very white publications. But either way, I would say that, look, know your client.
Mm-hmm.
Know your client and know what your client really wants.
How much of Think Like a White Man is you?
Mm-hmm.
And how much do you hide behind satire?
I'll say it's about 50-50 there, I say, almost like, almost 60-40 or so in favour of satire sometimes, or in favour of Dr. Boule Whitehall, because a lot of it, I have very, very firm beliefs on how the corporate world works,
mm-hmm.
and how the world works in general. But then I have a firm way in which I conduct myself as a professional too. And I probably wouldn't really say many of the things in the book out loud. Think Like a White Man really resonated with black people in the corporate world because of the fact it was real.
Mm-hmm.
It was real. It was their story.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, the book is hilarious, but it does make you think a lot deeper as well.
Thank you.
I'm going to read out some tips that I...
Oh, God.
Like, if you're black, wear non-branded glasses to show vulnerability.
What brand of glasses are you wearing?
Yeah,
right,
mine are branded, but I don't know what. But do you know what?
Yeah.
One thing I'd say, an anomaly to that,
mm-hmm.
Malcolm X.
Well, what brand did he wear?
Exactly. No. I don't think his were branded.
Neither would. So I wear.
So, but I didn't. He didn't look vulnerable.
He did not look vulnerable. It's
kind of because of the gun.
No, Malcolm X came to defy those glasses. They will be that. If you wear those glasses into the actual interview, so they'll be like, those are the Malcolm. So those glasses are not just unbranded. Those glasses are the Malcolms.
Okay.
And when you wear those into an interview, they just know immediately that, like, yeah, this guy's basically, yeah, you know I mean, this guy's basically in here right now with the Kalashnikov in his arm, in his suitcase.
Master names of sophisticated cheeses. What was a good one?
Yeah.
Put pics of light-skinned kids, even if they're not yours, on your desk. Embrace Uncle Phil, not Tupac baldness.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Which is very so that's like old Uncle Phil, not the new Bel Air Uncle Phil, because that is Tupac bald.
We're talking classic Uncle Phil.
Who went to my uncle saw Uncle Phil at the Million Man March.
Oh really?
So Uncle
Phil was on the Million Man
March. Yeah, so he's down.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my God, rest his soul. The original Uncle Phil.
Yeah, and God rest my Uncle Saul as well.
Oh,
yeah, passed recently. But yeah, Uncle Artie was at the Million Man March.
I see.
And so was Uncle Phil.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And the Million Man March is underrated in terms of who was actually there on that day or so. When you think about it, like, Uncle Million Man March was at 96, 95 or so. And that was like Uncle Phil at his peak of powers. When you think about it, one of the most famous black men in America at the time.
And was Uncle Phil.
And there he is, literally, Million Man March to hear Farrakhan speak. And
he would get cancelled in this day.
You couldn't do that today. Yeah. Today, the internet would tear you to shreds.
Yeah.
There's no way in which you could risk something like that today.
I also liked Rule 179. Do pander to white people's needs for fairy tales. Brexit is not about race. Neither is immigration. Seasoning is not a necessity. That sort of thing. What I loved about your writing is there was kernels of truth in all the jokes. So how do you get the kernels of these funny ideas?
Yeah, so I think that for me, when I was working in the corporate world, again, so we'll be in a meeting sometime. And don't get me wrong, I've lived a very, very funny life. So some of the stuff I've experienced in life is literally should not be happening. And sometimes I just read it like, this is happening for a reason right now. This, everything that's happening, I just mean myself, I'm going to write about this one day because this experience right here is insane. There's no way I should be experiencing it. And when I do experience it, also, I just think to myself, now I accept that, you know, I was placed here for a reason or so. It's to write these sorts of things about the human experience. And when it does happen, also, back in the day, I'd be so frustrated. But now I just look at it like, nah, this is happening because you're meant to write about this. This is your portion in life. This is what you're meant to do. But the kernels of truth in them also, I just think to myself, you look at the situation and you analyse it and you try and find humour in it. And it's the only way you can overcome it. It's therapy for me, personally. And it's just that, I think when I look at the people who inspire me as a writer or so, sometimes, in large part, comedically, certainly Paul Mooney.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Mooney's approach towards things was just utterly brilliant. His analysis, particularly his racial analysis, was of a vast intellectual scale. But he always made it sound funny. And I always found myself, when I was watching him as a younger person, I always found myself, yeah, how he writes or how he thinks, my brain is not a million miles from there, and I would love to write like that. And that's just how I went. Yeah.
And do people get offended by your work?
Yeah, loads. Yeah.
And how does that manifest itself? Because I love edgy humour.
Of course.
So I'm not very easily offended. So I just laughed at all of the shit.
I think that, so for me, I look at it like this, Johnny. I look at it like that. I'd love to say I don't care, but I do care.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have your cousin came the other day, right? And then one man,
Kayane Andrews. It's on top of his book at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely, on top of the New Age of Empire. And then, so I did an event with him last week, and then one man afterwards, he just came to me scornfully and said, I'm not happy with you. And I thought, what did I do to you? And the guy said, I had my hand up for so long, he didn't call me out. And I thought, brother, man, there's 200 people here. What's the matter with you? And I thought, but then I looked at the guy and I could see he was heartbroken that he had something to say. And it did kind of just, put myself, I wish I could just tell him we'd sit down, gather around, let this man speak again. But it didn't happen like that. So sometimes I have a people-pleasing element inside mm-hmm. me that I don't want to offend people. But when it comes to these things, I think I have a responsibility to say what needs to be said in a way that's actually A, going to make you laugh, and B, going to make you think. And I think that that's pretty much my portion in life. I think that's what hopefully makes me some money or so, because I've got a mortgage to pay and interest rates going up. But I think that's just what I'm meant to do. And I think, again, the same way in which Lionel Messi is meant to play football, that's what he's meant to do also. And everybody has one thing or another they are meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
And once you find that way to do what you're meant to do also, you have no excuse but to do it. And I think that's just me. That's just so me.
So how did it go from you're cracking jokes in person, you may be tweeting jokes occasionally. How did it go from that to getting stuff down on a page?
I just did it. I just thought to myself, now's the time.
And were you doing it while you were working, or did you quit and like, I'm going to be a writer?
Oh, no, I was writing. I was still working. So it's always, you're never not working. You have to. So being a writer, unfortunately, up until when you hit the big time, if you're lucky enough to do so, hopefully I will be. You just have to find a way to earn an income, so that's just the way it goes. So other than that, so the normal process for writing a book is that you pitch it to agents take it on board, and then they pitch it to publishers, and you said that didn't work for me, so I had to go round and round and round and round and round circles upon circles, and eventually Penguin Random House, bless them, they put together a program called Write Now, looking for new writers. And then underrepresented. Yeah, writers or so. And then it's clearly they're looking for black and brown people. So anyway, Penguin put together the actual scheme, and they just basically, they selected me, and I was really surprised, because even when they selected me, I said to them, are you sure there's a book called Think Like a White Man? It's a radical black satire. And the editors were very young, and they just loved it. They just said that, yeah, they immediately we just knew that this was one of the ones that's going to make it.
How long were you actually working in the corporate world for? Was it 18 years?
I was I did about 12 in financial services.
And how was
12
it?
12 in financial services, and then about 4 in media before I went freelance. Yeah.
And how did you find it? Because it's kind of very, there's a lot of talk about mental health in the workplace now and stuff. How did you find being one of the only black people in this corporate?
Some places actually were pretty diverse. Some places, so the good thing about it, the first place I worked in, there was no black people other than me. The second place I worked in was a place called Insight Investment, and it was quite a bit diverse here, and there's about 3 of us.
Too many. It's too many, man.
But the thing about Insight Investment, it was the asset management arm of HBOS, actually probably my favourite company I ever worked for, because that's a place where I picked up friends. And I think it also helped develop me as a writer too, because there's so many people, really, I won't say too many people because these are private professionals, but what we did there, it was that you're going to the office, but this was not a place where you're shy about talking about politics. So you had one guy who was a UKIPer there, you had people who were Brexit before Brexit ever happened, you had people who were left wing, and you had people, just everybody around there, socialists, capitalists or so, you name it. Just people were just openly flying their flags.
Yeah.
And we would openly discuss the politics day in, day out, day in, day out, day in. And that just became a really part of the day.
So there's a case study in I Think Like a White Man from Winston, if you remember.
Yes,
Winston.
I do.
Says that everybody needs a black and a white mentor.
Yes, mentor, yeah, absolutely.
So who were your, did you have a black mentor?
I did. He's actually an Asian man. He's actually the man who came up with the term. He wasn't black. He was a brother.
Politically black.
Yeah, he was politically black. He's a Cockney Asian guy, brilliant guy. I still see him from time to time now. I think back in those days. So Winston's a composite character between two people. One who was actually who wasn't actually fishing my mentor, was actually an older Jamaican man in the office who used to lace me with game all the time. Mm-hmm. Brilliant man. And there was also this Asian Cockney guy also, whose name is Vijay Patel. I'll give him a shout out right now.
We've talked about getting out of the situation you're in. How important do you think boarding in Nigeria was to that? You said you returned with some Nigerian arrogance, but how?
Yeah. Even though it wasn't justified, but yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, how important was that to kind of put you on the path that you ended up on?
I returned with Nigerian arrogance, I don't want people to mistake me for Kemi Badenoch. I was not that. Nigeria is a very, very strange place because it's a ruthlessly... Nigeria is a ruthlessly... Not ambitious, not the word. Nigeria is a ruthlessly... It's almost like an experiment. So, you know, they call America an experiment.
Mm.
Nigeria is a bigger experiment because America's cut down into a few ethnic groups. Nigeria's cut down into hundreds of them. And everybody's distrusting of everybody.
Finally, it's been amazing interviewing you. Thank you. Just want top three either films or books from you. And you can't include Bamboozled because you did another brilliant piece on Bamboozled. So I know that is like... possibly your favourite film ever.
It is.
You can't have that. But yeah, it can be TV shows, films, books, anything that has either favourite or has inspired you.
Yeah. Obviously, something that's inspired me is actually a book called by your cousin Cain DeAndrews, Professor Cain DeAndrews. He doesn't like being called Professor because he thinks it's almost akin to being called Officer. I think that, so for me, Cain DeAndrews' book, his latest one, Psychosis of Whiteness, is actually a very, very important read because it might sound like, when you read the title, you feel like, okay, they're just trying, he's trolling here. He's not. It's similar to, if you enjoy Think Like a White Man, you would definitely enjoy Psychosis of Whiteness. But it's much more credible than Think Like a White Man because he's really looking at how sometimes when you can't, that disengagement, are you with me, between where we stand on some things or so and say where, say, whiteness stands on something and the treatment to, say, black people or the treatment to ethnic minorities or not ethnic or global majorities. Is an intense one. And I think that Candy's explanations within it are very, very important. I think that it's how he just cuts through everything is just so really, really important on this one. I think he's done his best work, some of his best work with this anyway. So I'd really recommend The Psychosis of Whiteness. A film called Classified History X by Mario Van Peebles. I think it's his father or so, actually. Is it Mario or... who's the older one? Mm. Mario Van Peebles and then...
I think Mario's a younger one. Mario did Panther.
Yeah, who is his dad? His dad was...
But his dad might have been called Mario as well.
I think his dad was also called Mario Van Peebles. Mario Van Peebles made a documentary called Classified History X, where it's looking at just basically how black people are portrayed in media and history and everything else. And I think it's a very, very good film. Quite cutting edge too. And then in terms of just general films, so one of the films I actually find somewhat therapeutic to watch and somewhat interesting, because again, it's an immigration story, but it's a white immigration story. It's a very, very, it's a Stanley Kubrick film that I just like. It's a long playing film. It was based on a book that was written, I think, it's either 1825 or 1875. It's a film called Barry Lyndon, which so many people haven't seen or so.
I have not.
Barry Lyndon's a really, really good film. It's about three, 4 hours long. And sometimes,
it's
kind of two. It's got an interlude in the middle. But it's a film about this young Irish guy who ironically falls in love with his cousin. And then ends up, but his cousin's basically being married off to this posh English soldier, and he doesn't want to stand for it, so he ends up going on a duel with this English soldier, and the English soldier's just there, really looking down on the Irish, and the Irish just looking at the English guy, they want to get money out of him, and this English guy comes along talking about, I'm an Englishman, I will not tolerate this, I'm a man of property. I'm a man of respect and property, and the Irish would be like, the Englishman would say something like, I'm sick of your Irish ways over here. And the Irish would be like, well, if you're so sick of our Irish ways, we'll happily adopt your English ones. And you're then seeing, like, the same way which they treat us or so to some degree, you see these European nations treat each other like the Russians come aboard.
The blacks of Europe, the Irish.
Yeah, they were essentially. And it's just fascinating to see. And then you see this little Irish guy work his way right through European aristocracy to the very pinnacle. So I think Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, I'd recommend. The Great Kane DeAndrews is Psychosis of Whiteness, and Mary Van Peebles' Classified History. Booyah!
Nell's Abbey was in conversation with Johnny Wright for Writers Mosaic. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.